The next case on the court's oral argument docket this morning is Albert Thomas et al. Obviously, I won't read all of the parties in the caption for the appellants versus MEI GSR Holdings LLC et al. Case number 70498. Eisenberg, you ready to proceed?
I'm going to reserve 5 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing with trial counsel Jared Miller and John Tu on behalf of the appellants. The application that you're suggesting, with all due respect, is so absurd. The application you're suggesting is fundamentally unreasonable. Those were the words that the district court said at the hearing on the motion to dismiss, referring to the defendant's arguments as being absurd and fundamentally unreasonable. The district judge also said that the defendants invoked the jurisdiction of the justice court, and now that they've lost, they want to go back and say, wait a minute, we'd like to reconsider the laws by which we agreed to play. And that's exactly what happened here. This case truly is unique in just about every aspect of the case, from the fact that the plaintiffs spent $1.4 million in attorney's fees, costs, and expert expenses before the defendant moved to dismiss the case, up to the fact that the lawsuit was filed in the first place by the defendants. That sentence hardly makes sense, that the lawsuit was filed by the defendants, but in this case, the first lawsuits were filed by the defendants in justice court without any suggestion that NRS 38.310 apply. And then they stipulated to move the case to the district court, and the case was not consolidated, but the justice court cases were dismissed, and the district court actions proceeded, and the defendants filed counterclaims, again, never suggesting that the statute apply. And it's our position here that the fundamental...
On that point, Mr. Eisenberg, it appears to me that the motion filed by respondents for dismissal in the district court and the adjudication of that motion focused on whether NRS 38310 is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction of the district court, as opposed to whether the district court had jurisdiction, but nevertheless the issue under the statute is whether or not there's an exhaustion. That seems to me to be an important legal distinction here in this dispute. If this court were to conclude that the statute does not cause or does not affect the district court's subject matter jurisdiction, what would be your analysis of the case?
Well, I think it should be reversed. If the district judge...
Why isn't 38310 as a subject matter jurisdiction question?
It was originally raised as a subject matter jurisdiction issue by the defendants in their motion. The opposition tried to convince the court that it was not. The district judge concluded it was subject matter jurisdiction. Now, on appeal, the defendants seem to have backed off on that and said it doesn't really matter because it's justiciability. It's our position that whether you phrase or characterize the statute as subject matter jurisdiction, justiciability, or ripeness, no matter how you characterize it, you still get the same result because the concept of the separation of powers and the court's ability to police its litigants that come before it, we believe, trumps or supersedes any of those other questions. And that's one thing we tried to emphasize in our brief here, that the courts have to be allowed to control litigants before them. And before that motion was filed, these defendants engaged in 3.5 years of severe litigation abuse that cannot be exaggerated here. It's in the record. The judge struck their answer, entered a default, had a three-day prove-up hearing on liability and damages, awarded $8 million in compensatory damages. And it was only after that judgment was entered for $8 million, that the defendants moved to dismiss the case. So it's our contention that all of those things supersede, or they don't supersede, but the statute is not applicable, because whether you call it waiver or estoppel or separation of powers, that the statute simply cannot apply in this case, that it would be absurd. Now, we also contend that the statute was not subject matter jurisdiction because it doesn't say it on its face, and there's nothing in the statute that indicates that it's intended to be subject matter jurisdiction. If you characterize it as justiciability instead of subject matter jurisdiction, justiciability can be waived or subject to estoppel. Even subject matter jurisdiction can be subject to the doctrine of estoppel, as this court recognized in the Boysen case. Boysen was a divorce case, the husband submitted himself to jurisdiction of the district court, even filed a counterclaim, and then on appeal argued that the wife had not satisfied the residency requirement, which is a subject matter jurisdiction in Nevada in a divorce case. And this court said that the doctrine of estoppel applies because, number one, the husband acquiesced to the district court's jurisdiction, and number two, the husband filed a counterclaim asking for affirmative relief from the district court. And so he was estopped. That's exactly what we have here. We have defendants who filed lawsuits in the first place, never asserting the statute, then went through 3.5 years of scorched earth litigation, had their answer stricken, a case-concluding sanction. And then after everything else, after the three-day prove-up hearing and the $8 million judgment, then for the first time ever, they raised the jurisdictional or the subject matter jurisdiction statute, as they characterized. And it's our contention that as a matter of law, that was estoppel. And the judge should have applied estoppel.
Is 38310... is its application subject to waiver and estoppel?
Is the statute subject to estoppel? Well, I think the right to assert the statute, like almost anything else, if you can be estopped to assert a certain position, whether that position is based on a statute or a case or an affirmative defense or anything else, is subject to estoppel. And so we think, just like now the Boysen case, that was a divorce case. It did not involve 38.310. But the concept was the same, that the husband in that case was estopped. I see the timer is not working, but can I find out how much time?
7:30.
I'm sorry?
7:27.
Okay, thank you. I don't think it's working.
No.
No. The other issues that I'd like to discuss really have to do with application of the statute in the first place. Many of these claims for relief simply did not involve the CC&Rs or the Owners Association. It's not an HOA in this case. It's called a Unit Owners Association. But it just did not involve the statute in the first place. And the example I'd like to give you to illustrate how it would work is suppose you're going on vacation for 2 weeks. You give the key to your house to your neighbor so you can go in and water your plants. The first week you're gone, he rents it out to somebody without your permission, lets them move in, collects the rent. The second week you're gone, he gives your house to a business client of his to live in there rent-free. And you come back and find out about this and sue him for that. The fact that you both happen to be in a homeowners association and both happen to be subject to CC&Rs is irrelevant to that, to what your neighbor did to you. And that's exactly what the GSR did to these owners here. most of them, not most of them, but at least half of them did not have unit rental agreements, because almost all of them did earlier, but when the GSR took over in 2011, it terminated the agreement, sent new agreements to everybody, and only about half of them agreed to it. Yet the GSR continued to let people use their property, comps for high roller and gamblers, and continued to rent out their properties without permission, and then lied to them about how much they rented them for. Those claims for relief had nothing at all to do with the CCNRs of the Homeowners Association. And therefore, we contend that the statute simply was not applicable. And then, finally, and there are many other issues here, but the last one I wanted to mention is the Ham case.
Before you go to that, why is the analysis here any different than in McKnight? Justice Douglas spent a lot of time going through each specific claim. With the exception of quiet title, he concluded that every one of the claims, several of which are asserted in your complaint, were subject to the statute. Why is it any different?
Well, in the McKnight case, what he also said was that it deals with possession and use. And many of these almost all of them deal with possession and use. And some of them affect title, which is what McKnight also talked about, the fact that if it affects title, it's an exception to the application of this statute.
Okay. Go ahead, Justice Stiglitz.
Tom, is your timer working?
No.
You have 4:18.
15
yes.
seconds, so I didn't know if you
I think I was finished with your answer, but if you need more, otherwise I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
You'll have four minutes.
I did want to finish my thought on Ham, and that is the fact that the defendants here were not agents of the Owners Association, which is exactly what happened in Ham. The opposite side of the coin in Ham. In Ham, the court said because the collection agency was the agent, then the collection agency got the benefit of the statute. And the clear implication of that is that if it had not been the agent, then they would not have gotten the benefit of the statute, which is what we have here. These defendants are trying to destroy the Owners Association. So I'd like to reserve whatever time I have.
You'll have 4 minutes, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Paulsenberg will have 16 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's like the old days.
Yeah.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Dan Paulsenberg for the Grand Resort, Grand Sierra Resort defendants. Let me address the last issues first and then get to jurisdiction. One of those arguments that we just heard was raised for the first time in the reply brief, and that is that this has nothing to do with the declaration of covenants, conditions, and restrictions. That wasn't what their argument was in the opening brief or in the district court. They raised five reasons that 38.310 does not apply. The first one was that it doesn't apply to third parties, and that's based on the Ham case. And I have to ask the rhetorical question, third parties to what? It's clear that the collection agency involved in Ham had nothing to do with the interrelationship of the parties. But here, I don't think you can say that any of my defendants are third parties. They're declarants in the CCNRs. They're involved in contracts, three contracts, with most of these unit owners. It isn't the situation that we have at all in Ham. And in fact, it's been clear from McKnight that you're not just looking at the document that we call the Declaration of CCNRs when we're talking about conditions, covenants, and restrictions. We're talking about anything that involves the relationship of the parties. McKnight had to do with actions under 116, and this court said that Chapter 116 establishes regulations and statutes that contain conditions and restrictions. So we're not looking at anything so narrow as their new argument. We're not third parties here, and Ham was dealing with a third party We're not in that situation. Their second argument is that this has to do with the possession and use of property. No, no. The statute defines what a civil action is. And 38.300 says that a civil action involves the title to the property. A civil action, 38.303, the term does not include an action in equity or injunctive relief where there is an immediate threat of irreparable harm or an action relating to the title of residential property. That's what the exception is. Now, yes, this court in McKnight said possession and use, but this court was only explaining that a action to establish title goes to possession and use. It wasn't creating a new exception. The other exceptions that, and in fact, let me handle two at the same time. Judge Andy Gordon, in a lot of the federal cases involving 38.310, he used to say, no, it has to be an action by a homeowner against the homeowners association. And then he changed, and we cite the case Nation Star, where he explains why he is changing. And the reason he is changing, he says he used to follow the legislative history, and it said you had that it was focusing mostly on homeowners suing their HOA. And he says that I now reconsider that ruling. And there are a number of cases after this where he stays with the new ruling because the statute is not open. The statute's language is plain and unambiguous and is very broad and cannot be read to be restricted just to who the parties are in the case. And that also takes care of one of their other points where they say the legislative history says that this statute should only deal with small disputes. The statute doesn't have that restriction. And the legislature is capable of putting restrictions on their statutes. Their last two arguments are that their claims are that the contracts we have are unconscionable and only a court can render things unconscionable. Yes, you know what? Only a court can do anything. Even in arbitration, if you want to have that reduced to an enforceable order, you go to a court under NRS Chapter 38 and you make it an enforceable order. The fact that a court would ultimately be involved is no exception to the statutory requirement that you go through mediation.
But, sir, why should a party be allowed to use the system to their advantage, sit on their hands for 4 years, and when they get a judgment that's not in their favor, then say, hey, this should have been an arbitration? Why would we be encouraging that?
Well, okay, let's go to the jurisdictional issue then. I think this is a jurisdictional statute. I think this goes to subject matter jurisdiction. It has particular language in it that says no action, and it explains it, may be commenced in any court in this state. It is worded as a subject matter jurisdiction statute. Subject matter jurisdiction can't be waived. And it says any court. This would be the justice court. This would be this court. Subject matter jurisdiction under Rule 12G can be raised for the first time even on appeal. So the issue is the statute broad enough that it's subject matter jurisdiction? I think it is. Counsel says that I also made the argument it doesn't matter. He's right. I did make that argument. I don't think it matters if it's subject matter jurisdiction. Obviously, the Nevada legislature could not establish subject matter jurisdiction for the United States District Court for the District of Nevada. And those cases, and I have a very long footnote setting out those cases, say that, no, this is not something that it is an exhaustion clause. In other words, they read it even further than a subject matter jurisdiction clause. They read the last part, which says, subsection 2, a court shall dismiss any civil action which is commenced in violation of the provisions of subsection 1. They read that as an exhaustion provision that applies even in federal court. It's not just a limitation on state court subject matter jurisdiction. And exhaustion clauses, requirements to do things, are strictly interpreted by this court. There is one case, Sydell, S-Z-Y-D-E-L, I think it is, where Justice Hardesty dissenting says that 41.071 is a jurisdictional statute. Now, I don't think his disagreement with the majority went to the difference that we're talking about here. We have, throughout our statutory schemes, we have a number of statutes that require things. There's medical malpractice under 41A that I just talked about. Construction defect under 40, but that one of those provisions actually sets out a provision that you can stay those actions so that you don't run into a statute of limitations problem. Chapter 11 has a provision where for architects you have to have certain prerequisites. These are not just procedural. These are not just justiciability. It's not like the Boysen case, where there actually was jurisdiction even without the wife's claim because the husband had a counterclaim. It's not the airport case, the unpublished decision, where they were talking about standing. There are some things you can waive, and there are some things you can never waive. If I had won this case, and they had raised the statute, I would be without a remedy, and that action would have to be dismissed. I'd have to bring another action. And let me raise something else, because
I appreciate your argument, Mr. Polsenberg, and I feel like I understand both what you and Mr. Eisenberg are contending, but it does seem fundamentally unfair or unsound where the parties stipulate to the court's resolution of a dispute between them. I guess the question is, can they do that? Can they
stipulate? Subject matter jurisdiction, first of all, you can't do that. You can't stipulate to jurisdiction. The court would be under an obligation once it was aware of the issue. Either the district court or this court would be under the obligation to dispense. The
distinction between whether this is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction or whether it's an issue of exhaustion. That's, to me, a big difference, because I think one could waive the question of exhaustion.
I don't think the way this is worded, it could be waived if it were exhaustion, but I also think, as I said, that was a backup argument. I also think it's subject matter jurisdiction. Let me address your comment about stipulation. We didn't stipulate to jurisdiction. We had claims in the justice court. That's how small these claims are. We had claims against some plaintiffs in the justice court. They sued us in a big joinder action. Rather than have two actions go at the same time, both parties agreed that those claims that we had could be brought in the district court.
You also had counterclaims.
Yes.
Okay. Well, now, why isn't that?
The counterclaims are the claims we're talking about. The claims that we had in justice court, we then brought in
district
court.
So there's nothing additional other than those pending cases in justice court that you agreed to have transferred to district court?
That is certainly the impression I'm under.
Okay. And again, I had a few questions here, and clearly the judge was the judge was very reluctant to enter this determination based, and I understand you weren't trial counsel, based upon the egregious litigation tactics taken by the defendants in this case that ultimately caused case-ending sanctions. And, you know, it's, in looking through the judge's statements in the record, it appears he was even skeptical that there was any good faith basis that this was brought up 3.5 years later. I'm struggling with that. And as Justice Hardesty said, is this an exhaustion issue or is it a subject matter?
I know that there's a good faith issue because it could have been brought up before the prove up. And it would have gotten rid of the prove-up. There was no reason to have waited all this time for it. And besides,
you had a punitive damage hearing pending.
Well, that, you know, sometimes circumstances motivate legal research.
Certainly.
But let me tell you.
He was skeptical of that fact. And
Let's give him some credit, okay?
Yeah. And he saw this unfold. He saw all the abuses during the litigation going over 3 years.
And he awarded attorney's fees, and that would be the appropriate sanction for a a case where there isn't jurisdiction, and he could...
So he could order sanctions in whatever amount as litigation abuse.
This wasn't briefed, but I do know there's a line of cases about federal cases where a court has lost jurisdiction because of something that somebody did, and still is, it usually comes up in remand situations, but still is able to issue some kind of sanction. But, yeah. But you know, there's a recent opinion by Justice Gorsuch where he says judges shouldn't always be happy in what it is they do. If they're doing their job, they're going to occasionally be making rulings that they wouldn't be the thing they'd be most happy doing. And the district judge here certainly followed his judicial responsibility in reaching the correct legal result, although we personally might have wanted another result. Let me also say that... Yes, Your Honor.
But I'm struck by the fact that you went to court first. You went to court. You filed an action in a court. And
Justice
4 years later said, what the heck's this thing doing in court?
Yeah.
So, you didn't see a problem with that?
No, because there is a statute that says the court is without the ability to hear the case. If we had gone ahead, if we were the only ones with claims, and we'd stayed in the justice court and we got damages against those individual unit holders, they could raise the statute, and we would be stuck satisfying the statutory obligation to have ADR before litigation. Let me talk about the sanctions. I originally thought I would be appealing the sanctions. I don't think the sanctions are entitled to any deference. In fact, as much as they say bad things about me gratuitously in the opening brief, I gratuitously pointed out in the answering brief how we win quite a number of these claims as a matter of law. And so the sanctions were inappropriate. Now, I didn't raise that the sanctions are inappropriate because this court doesn't allow that kind of conditional appeal. But yes, if you reverse this and send it back down, we're immediately right back up on an appeal on the sanctions because I think the sanctions were inappropriate. But because I don't think the sanctions are enough, if you're going to rely on a technicality to win a case like a sanction instead of the merits of the case, where I don't think they are very strong on the actual merits without the sanction, if you're going to rely on that kind of technicality to win a case, what I call litigation by sanctions, you need to be technically correct.
I think to be clear, the issue in front of this court does not involve the sanctions.
I agree.
The issue before this court is the application of the statute in the context.
But their argument, Your Honor, is that the sanctions are the basis of the waiver. That our conduct, it is one of their arguments, that the sanctions form the basis for the waiver.
I didn't hear that in the argument this morning from Mr. Eisenberg. I don't read his brief that way. I understand him to be arguing that the parties jointly participated in this litigation process,
okay,
each seeking adjudication of their respective issues. So I'm going back to the beginning. I'm not focused on...
I'm glad you're not focused on that, and I don't mean to quarrel with you. There is a section in the reply brief about the sanctions being
I know that.
So here is, I think I am in the situation where we're talking about, how am I on time?
20 seconds.
Okay, then I won't go to that last point. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Olsenberg. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Eisenberg, you have 4 minutes. Yes.
Thank you.
And since the clock isn't working, you'll hear a bell or something.
No, it isn't, but maybe I could be warned at 30 seconds. There's several points to which I would like to respond. First, the stipulation itself. Mr. Polsenberg has tried to downplay the stipulation. What it says is the parties believe dismissal without prejudice, the present action is appropriate so that all claims between the parties can be resolved in the district court action. And the Justice of the Peace approved that stipulation, and then the case proceeded in the district court. I would also like to ask, when when does it end? Suppose the punitive damages case had proceeded and the judge awarded punitive damages, and there was an appeal, and the judgment was affirmed. And years later, the defendants asserted, oh, wait a minute, the court never had subject matter jurisdiction because of this statute. At some point, wouldn't the court say, no, wait a minute, you had your shot at it, you acquiesced with it, and you're estopped. Now, there's also a subtle distinction sometimes between waiver and estoppel. So which one applies here? I would suggest to you that it's more of an estoppel. And this court has said that even for subject matter jurisdiction, it's subject to estoppel. What the court said in the Gamble case more than 100 years ago, the court said, although subject matter jurisdiction may be raised at any time, it is also settled in this court that a party may, by his conduct, become estopped to raise such a question. And then, as recently as the Boysen case in 1969, same thing. Subject matter jurisdiction, the court said, they were estopped. So whether it's waiver or estoppel, I don't think makes a difference, although I suggest that it's more of an estoppel question.
Let me ask you this. Was that argued, do you know, and I know you weren't trial counsel below, the judge when he was making his determination that he had to dismiss this case because clearly he did not want to? And I don't know if Gamble was pointed out to him and a party by his conduct may be stopped.
It was, and my recollection is that the judge distinguished Gamble, either at the hearing or in the order, that he distinguished Gamble because it might be confusing it with another case, but I'm pretty sure he distinguished Gamble because there had been a trial, and he felt that in this case there hadn't been a trial.
And that answers my question. I don't want to chew up the rest of your time.
There wasn't a trial because the judge ordered case-ending sanctions. So under their theory, they'd be better off with the case-ending sanctions than without. And the sanctions, counsel says it wasn't briefed. The actual sanctions themselves were not briefed in this appeal, but the fact that the sanctions should remain was briefed, and we contended that even if the statute applies, you don't go back and erase everything that happens in the case. That the sanctions order and even the $8 million judgment should still stand. And the United States Supreme Court has addressed that. Counsel cited the Willie case. We discussed the Willie case as well, where the federal district judge, awarded sanctions. And then later on, it was determined that the judge did not have subject matter jurisdiction. And the U.S. Supreme Court had to decide, will those sanctions be able to stand even though the judge didn't have jurisdiction? The court unanimously said yes. And when a judge has entered orders, while the judge is under the misapprehension that the judge has jurisdiction, those orders stand.
And I know you're out of time, Chief. Do you mind if I ask one more question?
Sure.
Under that reasoning, then, you're equating the fact that as a sanction, the judge ordered case terminating sanctions, and the $8 million approval was part and parcel of the sanction imposed, and therefore, under the case you decided, the sanction should stand, the $8 million.
Well,
that's kind of what I thought you were arguing, but.
Well, then I need to clarify that. The $8 million award was not a sanction.
Okay.
The sanction was striking the answer of the affirmative defense and going to a 3-day prove-up hearing.
Okay.
The $8 million award was compensatory damages as a result of expert testimony.
So you don't view the propriety or impropriety of that sanction order to be an issue in this case now in front of us, do you?
No.
All right.
No. And if the court reverses and we end up with a multi-million-dollar judgment, then like any other appeal, they could raise any interlocutory orders,
sure,
including that.
Are there any other questions?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Paulsenberg, for your typically excellent arguments and briefing. We appreciate your input on the case, and it will stand submitted.
Thank you.